Well, good evening, everyone. It's very good to see you. I appreciate so much everybody moving up and in. That helps so much when teaching a class. I'm trying to teach a class over this whole auditorium. Let me tell you, that's just tough. And when we get to a point of making comments and all, it's harder to do that when everybody is just all spread out. So this is good. While I kind of hate to take any time talking about housekeeping type issues such as that, I want to just talk a little bit too just about what are we going to do with this class, because a lot of people have asked me and have said, how are we going to cover 24 chapters in 30 or 40 minutes? And my response has always been, I have no idea. I stand before you, I do not know what I'm going to do with this class. And I have worried about it all week, trying to figure out what is the format of this class going to be. And I think, as I've told some tonight, I think we're just going to have to try this out and see what is going to work best. And I don't know that there's going to be, one mold fits them all type of a thing. I mean, there's a part of me that would love to just kind of go through a quick touch and go on all 24 chapters as kind of a reminder of where we have been this week and what we've been studying. But I don't know that that's always going to be the best way to do it, and I don't know how we can do that. That's a minute and 15 seconds per chapter if you're counting, because I've tried to figure that out. That's pretty tough. Or maybe at some time we'll just go through and we'll pick out two or three main points of the 24 chapters and just talk about those. I mean, that would be one way to do it too. So we might do that sometime. Or sometime I might just preach. You might not like that part, but it just depends. I don't know. We're just going to have to feel this out and see what works, or maybe it's going to be a little bit different every time. I really like for us to have discussion in our classes, but I'm going to tell you that we're going to be real limited on what kind of discussion we can have in this class if we're going to try to cover a lot of chapters. In the class on Sunday mornings and Wednesday night in 1 Peter, we've been doing kind of a deep dive, and at this point, probably what, eight or 10 class periods into our study, we are in the middle of chapter 2. All right? But that's what that class is about. I mean, we are trying to understand the details of that text. We are not doing that in this class. We can't do that. Unless, on some occasion, we just take one story and talk about that for 30 or 40 minutes, which we might do sometime. So what are we doing tonight? I don't know. I told you. I don't know. I'm standing before you. I don't know what we're going to do tonight. We're just going to kind of see where this goes. But I think what I want to do is I want to start off with just some comments on some things. When I started reading Genesis chapter 1, there were just some things that stood out to me. You've heard me say that before. What stands out to you? I mean, that's kind of my method of study. Or I'll look at a verse and I'll think, what are two or three things I have got to take away from that verse or from that chapter? And in Genesis chapter 1, which is all, get over to Genesis chapter 1, we're just going to kind of flip our way through here tonight. Just some things that just stand out to me. In the beginning, God created. I mean, I know I'm simple-minded. You have learned that about me already. And when people try to discuss evolution and debate all of those kinds of things, all I think about is, in the beginning, God created. And that's as far as I can go. I am so ineffective in talking or dealing with somebody who has all the arguments of evolution in their mind, because all I can think when they're talking is, in the beginning, God created. That's what the text says. And if we don't believe that, you might as well take the book and set it aside. There's no reason to believe anything else in the book if we do not believe that in the beginning God created. That's a powerful statement. It tells us everything, and in so many ways it tells us everything about everything else that's written in the book. That it is God controlled, it is God breathed, it is God who has given this to us. And even as we go through chapter 1, I mean, we see God's presence in every way. In the beginning, God created. In verse 2, now the earth was formless and empty, the darkness over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of the God was hovering over the waters. I think we have God the Father represented. We have God the Spirit represented. Verse 26 tells us, let us make man in our image. To whom was God speaking? But I can only think and assume that it was his Son to whom he was speaking, who was there before the foundation of the earth. In the very first chapter of the Bible, we see God in his presence in such incredible, miraculous ways. And in my mind, simple thinking, I know, that's as far as I can go, is simple thinking. Genesis chapter 1 tells us so much about God. And when we read verse by verse how day by day God created this, then he created this, and he created this, that it was by God's word it 10 times, and God said, and God said, and God said, and God said, and it was done. Whatever he said, it was done. And I love the part 4 times when he stands back and he says, and it was good. He was satisfied with what he, and in the end he says, and it was very good. God was satisfied with his creation. I don't know why we wouldn't be satisfied with God's creation, because the Creator was satisfied with his creation. And that should make us satisfied as well. There was kind of a highlight, I think, in verse 27 where God created man. I would think that we would perhaps be a little bit partial to that. You know, that God created man. And I can't help but notice again, and God created man in his own image. And just think of the power of that. And heaven and earth, God created, chapter 2 and verse 4 says. Powerful, powerful words that we see. In chapters 1, 2, and 3, when we just kind of look at an overview of the creation as God saw it and as he called it into being, you know, day by day, the things that came to pass because God said. In chapter 2, with the creation of man, there was instruction, of course, that was given to man. And there was instruction that was just very simple and clear. Verse 16, and the Lord God commanded the man, you are free to eat of any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you shall surely die. You know, really, second grader probably could read that and understand the instruction and the directions of God. It's not difficult in any way to understand the directions of God. He's not made it hard for us to understand. His instruction was pivotal. It was informational. It was absolute. God's direction was absolute. In the latter part of chapter 2, when we see introduced the relationship of male and female, husband and wife, I think it's just as absolute. It's not good for man to be alone. God made for man woman. Woman was to be man's helper and his helpmate. And really, we see, I think, the establishment of marriage as it was authorized, or how we might even say regulated by God. It's God who regulates marriage. How dare us come up with ideas about what constitutes marriage? Who do we think we are? Remember verse 1, simple-minded here. Verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Let us make man in our image. It's God who is the maker and creator. And when it comes to the matter of marriage and what constitutes marriage, why would we ever think we have any right to determine what makes marriage? God made man for woman. One man, one woman for life. What more needs to be said about that? And yet it's debated in our time and society every day. Chapter 3, and I'm going to stop for a minute. God's words to man and his instructions to man were informational and absolute, not hard to understand, and yet we enter into the story. Because unfortunately, he has to enter the story at some point. And early in time, the serpent, Satan, enters the story. And he's identified that the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. The craftiness of the evil one cannot be overlooked. even as he says to woman, did God really say to you, you must not eat of any tree in the garden? Interesting how he just kind of works his way into this conversation about what they should or should not eat. Did God really say? He asks. And you think about how Satan works his way into our lives today. You know, in many different ways and different forms, those ministers of Satan who can somehow make us think about things we shouldn't think about, who can somehow convince us to do things that we know better to do, but it's in that very same way, you know, in that very crafty way. Did God really say you can? Did God really say? That's the way and the means of Satan. Satan will lie. He will just lie to us because he said to Eve, oh, you will surely not die. But it was God who said, you will die. It was in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And God said, and it was good, God said. God is the one who is in control. God is the one who makes the rules. God is the one who regulates things concerning life. And yet there's this one who comes along and contradicts God and says, oh, you'll surely not die. We have all been deceived at times, haven't we? When Satan has said, oh, you will surely not die. And so when I think of chapters 1, 2, and 3, these are some things that just stand out to me. Oh, wait, there's one more thing. That just really has to be mentioned in chapter 3. There's just this glimpse that is far-reaching because of the sin of man. Well, there's destruction that comes. There's punishment that comes. Just as God said, there would be death that would come. But at the same time, as God is explaining to the serpent the curse that will come upon him, there is, as he talks to the woman and to man, to the woman specifically, there is a glimpse of something when he says in chapter 3, verse 16, I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. No, this is not what I want. Go back to verse 15 as he's speaking to Satan. And I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and hers, and he will crush your head and you will strike his heel. There's a glimpse of something there. Looking at the big picture, now I'm asking for you. What are we seeing a glimpse of here?
Hope.
Hope. What kind of hope? Satan's not in control. And God, in a very somewhat subtle way, is reminding Satan and us that Satan is not in control. That there is one of greater power that will come. Well, we don't know what the story leads to at this point, reading three chapters. But in time, as we read through the story, we see what this alludes to and where this is going. All right. Briefly, any comments or thoughts that you have on the first three chapters here that you just want to throw out? Why are we here?
And God addresses that on the first
at the very beginning.
At the first birth, the first page.
Absolutely.
And that's unique.
Absolutely.
Unique to the Bible.
Unique because it comes from God. Sure. Other thoughts quickly? All right. Let's look big picture at some things. As we kind of just flip through and look at some of the Bible stories maybe that are familiar to us. You know, in chapter 4, we see a sacrifice offered by faith. By Abel. And I just want to make just the point here that at such an early time, there were some who listened to God. The sacrifice could not have been offered by faith if they had not been told what they were to do. And it was by faith that Abel responded in this way. And it just seems to me that something that stands out is choices. As God said to Cain, if you do what is right, will you not be accepted? He said to Cain, choices. At the very earliest of time, with Adam and Eve, there was choices, wasn't there? God has always given man choices. Cain made a poor choice. You know, his sacrifice wasn't what was pleasing to God. His actions after that were not what was pleasing to God. We have choices too. When we look at chapter 5, you know, we kind of read through the generations of Adam and Noah, you know, and just some generations that came along. I'm sure you've got all those names down really well and can say them. I'm not reading them because some of them I can't read. I hate doing that. But there's something in chapter 5 that stands out. His name, I should say something. There is someone who stands out in chapter 5. His name is Enoch. Why would Enoch stand out? He walked with God. I mean, what do we know about Enoch? He did die. All right. What else do we know?
All we need to know.
Yeah, we know all we need to know. I mean, in some ways, you know, Enoch, you know, is an incredible man, and yet what do we know about him? He didn't die. He walked with God. Jude has a couple things he says in Jude 14 and 15. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 5 says, again, that Enoch walked with God. What more do we need to know? I mean, here was a man of superior quality and character because he walked with God. And that's what we know about him.
It's important that we know he walked with God because at this time, the world was becoming very evil.
Things were changing rapidly.
A person who walked with God.
Yeah, and don't you imagine that a man like Enoch stood out to God? Because as we look into chapter 6 and the evil generations that's come along, there were those like Enoch that stood up and those like Noah. Okay, what do we know about Noah? I mean, some things about Noah that just stands out. I mean, there was a great wickedness in the earth and every inclination of thoughts of his heart was evil all the time. You know, regarding man is what it says in verse 5, the Lord was grieved. There seems to be a tremendous point of emphasis right here. The Lord was grieved. Can we even imagine how the Lord was grieved? I'm not sure that we spend the time thinking about and considering what that is and what that means, that the Lord is grieved. When he looks out at his creation, the disappointment that he had when he saw that the inclination of every thought and of the heart was evil all the time, and that his heart was filled of the Lord, Jehovah God, that his heart was filled with pain because his creation had become so evil. There's a great contrast here with Noah. That's one of the things that really stands out to me, the contrast. You know, all this is said about all the evilness of the time. God says, for I am grieved, I have made them. But, verse 8, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Noah, verse 9, Noah was a man of righteousness, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked with God. It's kind of like Enoch. Noah walked with God. It says everything to us about him. He was a righteous man. He was blameless. Verse 22 says that Noah obeyed God. And when you look at chapter 7, in the coming of the flood and the building of the ark, you know, Noah did everything that God had commanded. And as God rendered judgment upon evil, you know, people say sometimes, you know, I can't understand, you know, why God would destroy man. I thought he was a loving God. Well, indeed, you know, he is. But there was judgment that had to take place. The judgment was against evil. God cannot, he cannot endure evil. Righteousness cannot suffer evil. And God had to do something with the evilness. And this judgment had to be made. The ark comes to rest in Mount Ararat. Chapter 8 says, it's interesting today at some of the excavations that have taken place, you know, searching for the ark. For a long time, I kind of said, man, that's just crazy. Why do people even have to do that? You know, and I kind of pushed all of that off. And one time my dad said, I was kind of complaining about that. My dad says, well, you know, he said, someday they might find something in, and someone, you know, may take some interest in the Bible that never had interest before. And I said, well, maybe that's right. And there are those who have searched and searched for Noah's Ark. Some have said that they have found it. I don't know that anybody has found anything. I really don't know. I haven't kept up with that. But it is interesting of how some have gone searching for those things. When the flood was over, Noah built an altar and sacrificed a burnt offering. It was an aroma that was pleasing to God. There was kind of a start over here, you know, and Noah was blessed in such a way and told to replenish the earth. And there was God's promise that was made in chapter 8. Remember, what was God's promise? His covenant. The rainbow. The rainbow was a reminder. The rainbow was a reminder, really, of the covenant of what? That God would what?
Not
destroy the earth by a flood. Yeah. Chapter 9. In chapter 9, God blessed Noah. Again, be fruitful and multiply. And, you know, Noah, you have whatever the earth offers, you know, to man over beast, eat greens and eat meat, you know, as well as the command that's given. Life is in the blood is something that really kind of stands out in that first part of the text right there. I mean, the shedding of blood, give an account for shedding innocent blood. You know, there was something serious said there about that. Remember, man is made in God's image. Seems to be a point that's brought out there again. There's some sin that enters in again, like one of the sons of Noah, Ham, who failed to show respect to his father. And Ham was cursed. Shem and Japheth were blessed. And there's some explanation given of, you know, their families and lineage and some things as that. The nations of Noah's sons, this is interesting to me in chapter 10, where it really gets into that lineage more. And yet, you know, you see here there was great cities that were built, and it's kind of the lineage of Ham and Japheth and Shem. And they spoke different languages, it says, and yet we come to chapter 11, and we have the Tower of Babel, and they all spoke one language. Explain that to me.
Dialect of the same language. Whereas afterward it was actually separated into different languages.
This could be right, this could be true. It could be too, you know, and I really don't know about this. You know, that some have even suggested that some of the things that's written in chapter 10 maybe is some things that actually happened after the Tower of Babel, when they went different ways and great cities were built in different areas and things like that. I don't know. It's an interesting thought. And lends itself to some explanation there. What was the big thing about the Tower of Babel? I mean, what was man's purpose first? Yeah, they will. Why?
He wanted to create a kingdom that's centered around man.
Okay, about man. I mean, in part, what was said, you know, let's make a name for ourselves. It was about them. And God was the one that kind of put an end or sorted this out, you know, and kind of changed the direction of man. You know, it was a defiance of God, really, I think, is what it was. Chapter 12 is interesting. When we come from this point of man's defiance of God, we come to a focal point with a man named Abram. And some things that are said to this man, Abram. God comes to him and tells him to leave his country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. What are the things that stand out in chapter 12 that we have to take away from this? What are the promises that God makes? There are some distinct things here. What does he say? We see these promises, a glimpse of hope for man, these promises that come from God. You know, leave your country and go to the land I will show you. Well, what land is that? He didn't really say, did he? But there's a promise here of a land. What's that land going to be in time? What's going to be the fulfillment of that land promise? Canaan. This land of Canaan. You know, then he promises, I'm going to make of you a great nation. Well, Abraham is just a man, and I don't know that he has much anything. How can he be a nation? What's the idea of there being a great nation that he's offering? What's that speaking of?
His descendants.
Yeah, well, and where are they going to be? Where are they going to become? What's the nation they're going to become?
Israel.
Yeah. Now, how much of that do you think Adam really understood? Well, he understood any of that. I mean, he understood that God was making a promise, but could he have understood it all, what that promise would entail about where he was going or what this great nation would be? And then, you know, what about this, all peoples will be blessed through you? Seed promising, you know, as was said. What's that about? Yeah, through Christ. I mean, if this was all of the book we had, I don't know that we could understand that. But as we go through the story, we will start seeing that there's some great substance to all of these promises. And in particular, to this promise of all peoples being blessed through the lineage of Abraham. You know, that seed promise is a seed. Galatians chapter 3 and verse 16 really helps us to understand that seed is talking about there is about Christ. And we see some fulfillment of that. And so Abraham goes off just as God has told him to do. There's some great stories as we go through some of the rest of our text here. In chapter 13, Abram and his nephew Lot. I mean, some incredible stories here about some things that unfold and decisions that can be made. Decisions that Lot made that is going to affect his life and the life of his family to come. You know, and some great applications that we can make. I think we'll talk about that at another time. I might just preach about that at some point. Because that deserves some special attention, I think. Going into chapter 14 as well, it's still Lot who is caught up in this turf war between some kings, and it's his uncle Abram has to come and rescue him. We enter into the story in chapter 14, a man named Melchizedek. In a brief way, what do we know about Melchizedek? Well, we don't know much. But what are some things about this Melchizedek that stands out? I mean, if I ask, who is Melchizedek? Quickly, what are some things? Who is Melchizedek?
King of Salem.
Okay, what else? What do we know about him? Priest. He's a priest, okay? What else?
Priest of the Most High God.
Priest. Yeah, priest of the Most High God. All right. Abraham worshipped him, you know. And Abraham would have been a pretty important guy at this point. Interesting that Abraham would be the one that would bow down and worship this king and priest of Salem. What is he a type of? Of Christ. I mean, what other king do we come across who is priest and king?
Jesus.
Yeah, Jesus. I mean, all of the kings that we look and we study about through the Old Testament, I mean, we have kings and we have priests. Jesus is the only one that we would find in time who is priest and king. You know, just some interesting things. There's a lot we don't know about Melchizedek. But just some interesting things that stand out there, you know, about him. Okay, let's see. What are some other points? As we think about the last 9 or 10 chapters here, what are some things that you just think we really need to make mention of? Chapters 15 and going forward. Look at that for a moment. What are some things you think we just really need to remember?
God's fulfillment of the promise of regarding Isaac, you know, that he did fulfill that promise, even though
it seemed unlikely.
Abraham was 100 and
Sarah
was
90.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about Sarah's attitude regarding this promise of a son? She laughed. You know what I've thought for a long time is that Sarah didn't believe God. You know what? I don't think that's right. I've had to kind of change my thinking on that. And I base that really from Hebrews chapter 11, verse 5. There's something said there about Sarah. You know what said? You remember? By faith, Sarah, being past age, delivered a son. And so I've had to kind of adjust and think again about what I've said. Sarah did not believe God. You know what? She laughed. She kind of must have thought, this is incredible. Could this really be? But ultimately, she believed God. Because the Hebrew writer says it was by faith that such things happened. Let's go kneel in there.
His time and his way, we don't have to fix it, just take care of it.
And always, that he will always fulfill his promises. Not always in the way that we think it needs to be done or when, but God will fulfill his promises. Barry?
So the prior point for Ralph in 17, verse 17, Abraham laughed.
Yeah. Yeah, he thought it was ridiculous too. How could it be, you know? And, I mean, did Abraham question, could this be possible? I mean, he seemed to get a little impatient, didn't he? He and Sarah both. Yeah. Hagar was offered as a compromise here on the seed being passed along, you know? Do you have anything? Okay. All right, good. All right, what else stands out? Looking through, what are things we need to mention? I mean, incredible. Chapter 24. You're right. 22. Wow. I would not want God to test me that way. I'm afraid of my faith in that regard. Would I have that kind of faith? I mean, we can all kind of think about it in some way and relate when we think of the story. We read the story here about Abraham offering Isaac, and we just go, wow. What else can you really say? I mean, not just that God was testing him in this way, but that the way Abraham responded, that's what is just incredible. You know, and it was like, you know, when he was told, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and here's what I want you to do. And verse 3 says, early the next morning, Abraham got up and sat with his donkey. He didn't think about it. He wasn't debating it. He just did what God said.
It looked like that God saw himself in Abraham.
Say it again.
God saw himself in Abraham. He saw him willing to give his son.
Yeah. Right. Your only son. It's interesting. Interesting how God says, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love. Isn't that a powerful statement? Because it's exactly what God would do. His only beloved son.
You see, in Abraham, whose faith grows. His faith was weak. God initially tells him.
Mm-hmm. You want me to go where? Oh, yeah.
His faith is weak when he lies about
Sarah being
his wife. Mm-hmm. He doesn't trust that God will save him or protect him. But then, through the wars with the kings and other things, God's demonstrating his care, Abraham. By the time we get to this point, Abraham has the faith.
Oh, yeah. Whatever God says at this point, I mean, he's ready to do. Isn't that something? I mean, how God really knows how to mold us, how to increase our faith. If we will respond to him, he will increase our faith. God knows what we need. God knows how to increase our faith. And when God tells us to step out, and we just need to do what God says, because we will benefit, our faith will be increased.
The verse in Hebrews 11, verse 19, where it says, he considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back.
Yeah.
You can actually see that faith in Genesis without looking at Hebrews.
That's right.
Because what he says to the servants is,
God will provide.
I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you.
Yeah, amazing.
He doesn't say anything about the boy not coming back.
Yeah, that's true.
He says, we'll come back.
That is true. Powerful stories in Abraham and his room.
Already destroyed the earth with the flood, and then we here have the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, who will destroy evil, and eventually all evil will be destroyed. Mm-hmm. And we need to remember that always as we are deciding how we want to live.
When what we start seeing with God at such an early time, an early age, is that He is a just God. That he cannot use, he cannot tolerate evil, and he has to separate himself and his people from evil. Were he not to do that, he would not be God. He would not be Jehovah God, who is incredibly just and fair. And the Bible stories you go through the Old Testament is what helps us to see that. I'm afraid sometimes when we come to a point of saying, I cannot believe that God would judge these people or that God would reject these people, it's because we do not know God. And we need to know Him. Failure to do so will separate us from Him. Our time is gone. God willing, here, what we'll be doing this week, tomorrow morning is Genesis chapter 25. And we continue on our read, 25 through 48, I think, is where we're going to. And so if you're behind, you know, maybe get some time, you can try to catch up some. If you just can't catch up, go to Genesis 25 tomorrow. Just start right there. Go with us from there tomorrow. Let's do this together. Let's stay together on this as best we can and just keep moving forward. And then next Sunday night, we'll do this again in some form or fashion. And kind of work through talking about some of those chapters. Really appreciate you being here and appreciate your comments tonight. I forget who's closing us out in prayer tonight. Neil's going to be. Ladies, remember to pick up your books over here. They're in this box and sign off on your name and day. Neil, why don't you come up here and at the microphone and lead us in prayer. Let's stand together here. We'll be dismissed after this prayer.